Feeding the Flame by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 10. A gem cannot be polished without friction, nor man perfected without trials. Breakfast was soon over. One doesn't take long to consume a breakfast consisting solely of 150-gram boiled egg, 1 piece of bread, and 5 grams of butter. The 2 cups of tea permitted did not take long going down the hatch either. The old man pressed the button on the left-hand side of the bed, and a motor whirred, and the back section lifted up to a 45-degree inclination. "Oh," smiled Cleo, "I do love it when that thing goes up." "Well, I have work to do now, and you wretches mustn't disturb me again. You know what fun we had yesterday, don't you?" The end of Miss Cleo's tail twitched with amusement, and she sauntered off to her accustomed place on the windowsill, right over the radiator. "What fun yesterday?" asked Rab. "I don't remember any fun yesterday." The old man looked up and said, "I tried to do some of the book in the afternoon, and Fat Cat Taddy said I mustn't do it. She said I didn't look well enough, and when I wouldn't stop, she told me again, and then she kept jumping at me and slapping me."
"Good for her," said Rab. "She's just looking after you."
"Yes, she's sure looking after me, but she kept on jumping at me and trying to push things out of the way. She tried to sit on my chest so I couldn't work. And if I don't get on and do this book, who's going to pay for all the doctor's bills?" The old man thought with considerable gloom of all the people still making money out of him. Secker and Warburg, for instance, first published The Third Eye. Oh, about 15 years ago they published it in hardback form, and then they sold the rights to a paperback firm, and ever since, Secker and Warburg have been taking 50% of the royalties on the paperback edition. And the same thing happens with Doubleday in the USA. There are other publishers who are dipping their hands in, and, as the old man said, it's no wonder he never had any money when there were so many people, including the tax collectors, who were trying to get a share of the money that he earned. The old man thought always in the kindest terms about Corgi of England, because throughout a long association there has never been any disagreement, never one word of dispute, between Corgi and him. He thought with considerable affection of his agent, Mr. A. S. Knight, of the firm of Stephen Askey, a painfully honest man who has always done his best, and, as stated, the old man had a considerable affection for him. That all came about because a former agent with whom the old man was dealing said, "If you know of a better agent, find him." And the old man did just that, Mr. Knight. But now was the time to work once again, the time to pass on a few more bits of information to people who would appreciate it. The old man turned over his papers, and Fat Cat Taddy raised her head and glowered and sent the strong telepathic message, "No larks now. You cannot do too much at once, or this time Cleo and I will both jump on you." Having said that, she curled up comfortably and waited further developments.
Quite a lot of questions came to the old man. Quite a lot of letters. People wanting things, wanting help, wanting suggestions, but most of the people wanted the old man to agree with them so they would be justified in their own minds. So many people wrote in about love affairs, asking the old man to decide between that person or some other person, asking if they would be happily married, and all the rest of that, but most of the people did not want any advice that meant doing anything. They just wanted to be told that they were doing satisfactorily and needn't make any more effort. They wanted to be told that fate was too hard on them and that they were worthy of the deepest sympathy and just give up and don't do anything. You can't fight against fate. You can, you know, if you want to. People come to Earth with a very carefully worked out plan of what they're going to do. They are fired with enthusiasm and determination. They know exactly how successful they're going to be in the forthcoming life. So they set out on the journey to Earth like crusaders, full of zeal. When they get down to Earth, and when they have a few years' experience behind them, inertia or lethargy sets in. They get disillusioned with life, which is a more polite way of saying downright lazy, which is actually the truth. People try to evade their responsibilities, try to shirk the plan which they, and they only, approved, because, remember, nothing is forced upon a person. A person comes to learn certain things, to experience certain things, but they are not made to. In the same way, a student who goes to a university, well, he didn't have to go. He doesn't have to learn certain things unless he wants to. If he doesn't learn, then he won't get the desired qualifications, and that's all there is to it. It's his choice. People ask for advice and guidance. They absolutely vow that they will follow the advice, but then they go on in their most erratic way, a way that is something like trying to drive a pig to market. Have you ever driven a pig to market? No? Well, it's like this. You have two long sticks in your hand, and you get behind the pig, and then you try to drive him forward in a straight line, and the stick in each hand is to give him a little tap if he doesn't keep to the prescribed course. Nowadays, of course, pigs get driven in trucks to market, which is altogether too easy. But people try to do everything except the obvious. People cannot understand that the path is here, right beside them, right in front of them. The path is within reach. People won't believe that. They think they have to travel to some exotic country and seek the path there. They think that they have to go to Tibet and get a guide or become a Buddhist. The number of people who claim they have Tibetan lamas as guides, well, there just isn't the population in Tibet. And the number of people who write to me and tell me they're going to Tibet to study in a lamasery indicates that so few people really read the truth. They can't go to Tibet. The communists are there. The lamaseries are closed. It's just silly to think that, because a person is all fired up with enthusiasm, that he can go charging off, leaping across the oceans and landing with a plonk in Darjeeling, and then making his way on an outstretched red carpet to the nearest lamasery. What do you think the communists are there for? They are there to stop religion. They are there to kill off lamas. They are there to enslave innocent people, and they are doing it because there doesn't seem to be anybody who's going to lead the Tibetan people out of the wilderness, out of the darkness of communism, and into the light, such as it is, of the free world. It should be emphasized once again that if people seek advice and receive advice and then ignore advice, then they are much worse off than if they did not seek help in the first place, because when the path is pointed out to them, when they are told what they really should do after having invited suggestions, then, well, they add a bit more to their karma if they do not do it. So, if you do not want to do anything about your state, about your dissatisfaction, do not seek advice. Otherwise, you're just adding on a bit to your own load. Now, here is another question. The idea has been gleaned that efforts to bring about healing of the sick may be ill-adjusted, interfering with the karma the patient is working off, and such helper may be subsequently burdened with the patient's karma. If this was true, what about the practicing physician? What a load of karma he must get. Is one supposed to try and help and heal or not? Poor old karma takes a beating once again. Not everything is due to karma, you know. People tell me that I must have a terrible karma to have such a difficult life, but it's not that at all. For example, if you go out and do some hard work, dig a ditch or run a mile, that may be hardship to some people, but you may be doing it because you like it, or because you're studying something. You may dig a ditch to see if you can discover some better way of doing it. Many people come to this earth with a definite plan that they will have a specific illness. It might be TB, it might be cancer, even a chronic headache, no matter what it is. That person can come with a definite plan to have some definite illness. A person may come as a mentally sick person and be doing an extremely good job of studying mentally sick people. It doesn't at all mean that because a person is mentally sick that they're burdened down with karma. On the contrary, they may be coming so that they can study at first hand mentally sick people. And then, when they return to the other side, they can help through the astral world those who are sick upon the earth. A physician or surgeon is in a special category. He can help those who need to be helped. He can operate on those who otherwise would die. And the sufferer, if he or she came with the intention of studying illness, would be able to study how the suffering of such illness may be alleviated. Let me make this statement. So-called faith healers do tremendous harm by setting up conflicting vibrations. The faith healer may be full of good intentions, but then the road to hell is paved with good intentions, people say. And unless the faith healer knows the exact cause of an illness, it is definitely, definitely harmful to start up all this so-called healing business. It just sets up a jangle in the aura, which all too frequently makes the condition worse. In these miracle cure cases, it is sadly all too frequent that the person did not have the illness in the first case, but merely had a neurosis. Some people can delude themselves for years. They can go into a state of auto-hypnosis. Yes, they've got cancer. Yes, they've got TB. Yes, they've got everything. They can go to a doctor's waiting room, hear a few other patients discussing their symptoms, and then the neurotic person copies the whole bunch and gets one illness after another. Now, if a faith healer can come along and cure that, often there is a serious breakdown after it. Quite frankly, I have no time and no patience with these faith healers. If you are ill, go to a recognized doctor. If you need other specialized attention, a qualified doctor will advise it and tell you where and how to get it. But to just send a sum of money to somebody who advertises in the Tomcat Times about faith healing, well, that really is insane. A recognized doctor naturally does not add to his karma in helping to cure the sick. This business of karma is so dreadfully misunderstood. It doesn't at all mean that if you're going to help a person, you're going to take on all his hardships onto your own back. It means that if you do an ill service to a person, then you have to pay back. If, through your viciousness or your violent temper, let us say, you shoot a person and impede the accomplishment of the task which he was doing, then you have to pay by having your own path impeded. Forget about hellfire and damnation, because there is no such thing. No one is ever abandoned. No one is ever condemned to torments. The only suffering and torment that you will experience when you leave this earth is when you enter the hall of memories and see what stupid things you have done. And that is easily overcome. If you really do your best now, while you're still upon the earth, you can be assured that your visit to the Hall of Memories will not be so bad after all. Of course, your face will be red, but, well, no wonder. Think of some of the things you've done. Think of some of the things you haven't done. Here's a question about telepathy. Could more details be given regarding the means of reaching the octave for telepathy between animals and man? How can a cat wavelengths be intercepted, for instance? If you want to talk telepathically with animals, you have to be in complete rapport with those animals. You have to be able to think as they do. You have to love them, and you have to treat them as equals. Most people regard animals as some inferior species of life. They think of animals as dumb clucks or dumb creatures who just cannot speak and therefore haven't any brains. Let me tell you that many humans think that deaf humans are mentally bereft. If you have ever been deaf, or if people thought you were deaf, you would often hear them discussing you, saying, "Oh, he's a bit weak in the head. He doesn't know what we're saying. Don't bother with him." Animals are in every way the equal of the human animal. They're just in a different shape. They think along different lines. And because they think along different lines, their basic wavelength is different. But let me give you another cause for thought. Can you telepathize with a fellow human? No? Do you know why? Throughout the years, humans have distrusted humans. Humans try to conceal their actions from humans. There's always, more or less, the intent of deceiving fellow humans. So you try, subconsciously, to make the wavelength of your thought transmission at variance with the thought transmission of other humans. Then they can't pick up your thoughts. If there was true brotherly love on this earth, everyone would be telepathic with each other. It is only humans who are not telepathic, or rather, only humans who cannot use telepathic ability. I speak to my cats quite as distinctly, quite as easily, as I speak to any human. I speak to that big fat cat Taddykins, and she gets my message with absolute clarity, and I receive her reply. And often the beauty queen Cleo will come rushing out of another room so that she can take part in any discussion. Woman-like, she likes to have the last word. If you want to talk telepathically with animals, you have to love them. You have to treat them as an equal. You have to realize that they think differently from humans, but they are no less intelligent because of that. An Englishman and a Spaniard construct their sentences differently, but then so do a German and a Frenchman. The basic message is the same, but the actual construction is different. It is even more so between human and cat. You also have to take into consideration that from the cat's viewpoint of things, it's different from that of a human. So unless you can think as a cat, much of the messages you would receive would be somewhat incomprehensible to you. As an illustration, I was given a message about something I wanted. This was when I lived in Montreal. I got an actual picture of the shop where the article was for sale. But of course the picture was from a cat's eye view of a few inches from the ground. And from that peculiar angle, I just could not get the name of the shop, because of the extreme elongation of the letters of the name seen from near ground level. Only when the cat, specially to oblige me, jumped on top of a car, could I actually read the name through the cat's eyes. Yes, I got the article, and it was quite satisfactory. There are many such instances. I wanted something for research, and no shop could supply me. So Miss Taddy, our highly gifted telepathic cat, sent out a general call on the cat's telepathic wavelength, and we received the desired information from a French-Canadian cat. So here in New Brunswick, we have received a message from a cat in the province of Quebec. And an urgent telephone call really, truly did locate the thing that I had wanted. I had no idea where to get it, but by contacting cats, I was soon in possession of the article. I have a friend living many thousands of miles away, and through receiving telepathic messages, he has been saved much trouble. Miss Taddy was in touch telepathically with a cat who lives near my friend, and this cat, who was quite a good telepath himself, was able to inform Tabney of certain things. Then I got in touch with my friend and gave him the information, and he confirmed that everything was actually as I said. If people would practice telepathy, they could soon put the telephone companies out of business. Perhaps you and I should get together and set up a special telepathic telephone communication system and make ourselves rich. Here's another question, which possibly is a little belated and, like most other things in this book, will be out of place. Before I say about the question, let me say something else. In this book, I have deliberately had questions higgly-piggly, otherwise too many people would just run to that question in which they were interested, or that section in which they were interested, and ignore the rest of the book. They would then write and complain to me that I had not dealt with such and such a thing, which they had not read, because they forgot to turn the page. Well, here is the question. It is the spirit that survives, isn't it? Now, when a person has a mental affliction, does that mean that it is more than a physical impairment, something that will not be left behind when we pass into another existence? Or will a person automatically be free of it as soon as the spirit gets out of the body, just as one wouldn't feel a broken leg, for instance, on the astral plane? Many people come down here with a deliberate mental affliction. They come down to see at first hand what it is like to be mentally impaired. It doesn't mean that their karma is faulty at all. That is nothing to do with it. You might say that a horse who has a handicap in a race has karma, and that would be absurd, wouldn't it? In some races, I understand that horses who are consistent winners have a handicap in that they have to carry certain weights, which are assumed to slow them up a bit and give other horses a chance. Mind you, I know very little about horses. I have never yet found the brake pedal on a horse, but I do know which is the front end and which is the rear. The front end bites, and one also has to avoid the rear end for various other reasons, which we need not detail. No horse would be accused of having karma when it carries handicap weights. In the same way, no human would be accused of having karma when he or she comes to this earth with a deliberate derangement or malfunction of some organ. And if a person should come here as a raving lunatic, that would have no effect whatsoever on the astral body. The insane part is shed when the astral body goes home. In addition to the class of person who comes with the deliberate affliction that he may study the matter, there are those who, through mischance, are injured, perhaps through a mother having a faulty diet, or possibly through a midwife or a doctor using instruments in a faulty manner. For an illustration, let us say that a doctor uses instruments and damages the skull. Then the person may have a definite mental impairment as a result of that damage. But it's not necessarily the person's karma paying him back. It could be an accident, a mischance, and nothing more. Nor does it mean that the poor wretched doctor has got a load of karma added because some things are accidents. And it does not mean that if a person has a definite, unavoidable accident, he's going to be saddled with karma. There's such a lot of misconception about karma. The person who comes down and is injured through a complete mischance gets credits because the failure of that life was not of his making. If he's very badly impaired, that is, if he is what we term a human vegetable, then the astral itself will go and take up residence elsewhere, and the human vegetable will then continue to tick over throughout the rest of the life, getting neither worse nor better. There is no way known on earth whereby an action on earth can make an astral entity insane. The nearest one can come to it is when one takes drugs excessively. If one takes drugs to excess, then the astral entity is very definitely affected. Not to the extent of being violently insane, of course, but it does cause a bad nervous condition, and that has to be cured by quite a long sojourn in an astral hospital. Much the same conditions prevail when a person is a real out-and-out alcoholic, because through his drunkenness, he has loosened the bonds between the astral and the physical and has actively encouraged lower-grade elementals to attack the silver cord or even to take over the physical body completely. This causes a very severe shock to the astral, and again, while it does not cause insanity, it does cause shock. The shock is akin to that which you would experience if you were asleep and a whole gang of rowdy kids beating drums and sounding trumpets jumped on your bed, not just appeared in your room, but actually jumped on your bed. You would suffer a severe shock. Your skin would become pallid, your heart would race, and you would get palpitations, and generally you would begin to shake all over. Well, when you had beaten up the kids and tossed them out, you would be perhaps an hour or two before fully recovered. But if your astral body had got into this condition through an alcoholic state, or through excessive taking of drugs, you might be several years in the astral recovering from it. And that brings me to another question, which is, what is this about powers that live on the astral plane at times affecting the silver cord? Let us visualize the prevailing conditions. Suppose we were sitting on the top of a building, perhaps in a very beautiful penthouse, with a nice roof, and we were lolling at ease, but at the same time keeping contact with the person right down on the ground level. We were keeping contact through, if you like, a pair of telephone wires connected to a headset on us, and a headset and mouthpiece on the person right down on the ground floor. We are picking up his impressions and listening in to all that he says and hears. Our telephone wires are such that they can pass through trees and walls without being disturbed, but they can be disturbed by a certain type of entity. Down below, also, there's a gang of hoodlum kids yelling and whooping around. They keep on trying to catch this telephone cable, and when they do catch it, they try to break it or even lay it on a stone on the ground and give it some hearty bashes with another stone. Although they cannot break it, they can cause considerable bruising and disturbance. It also impedes the poor wretch who's trying to talk and move about. Now let us put this in astral terms. We are down here on the earth, unfortunately, and our silver cord stretches upwards to the astral world. If we are weak or afraid, that is, if our authority is not respected, then any low-grade elemental through whose territory our silver cord passes can take a grab at it and do it, or try to do it, much the same as the children on Earth tried to do to the telephone wires. Perhaps they cannot actually touch it, but they can impress signals upon it by magnetic induction, in just the same way as one can speak into a microphone attached to a tape recorder, and our messages spoken into the microphone are magnetically impressed on the tape, which is passing through the recording head. Now, supposing we are making a tape recording, we are busy doing our best diction, making our best composition, and we're quite proud of the job we're making. And then someone sneaks up behind us and shouts, "Boo!" into the microphone. It causes a disturbance. It shakes us considerably, and it leads to irritation on the person's part when listening to the recording. If children respect one, and for that one has to really scare the daylights out of them, they will not do such things as to try and shout into microphones, etc. In the same way, one must absolutely and utterly show that one is not a bit afraid of the elementals. The elementals work hard at trying to make astral-traveling humans afraid of them. They blow themselves out, they put on their fiercest looks, and they utter the most outlandish cries one can imagine. Actually, the lower astral, the world of the elementals, is very much like the really insane ward at the local hospital. However, provided one maintains discipline, and it's easy, and provided that one is not afraid of these stupid elementals, and that's easier still, then there is never any cause to worry about interference from astral entities. Remember that nothing whatsoever can upset you or disturb you or hurt you unless you are terrified. If you are terrified, then your own state of fright, and only that, will cause your chemicals to be upset. If a person receives a bad fright, it upsets one's digestion in the physical, and, well, that's all there is to it, you really cannot be hurt. But you cannot be even disturbed if you refuse to be frightened or intimidated. Now, here's a question which was asked by a mother. The question is, when children go to the other side, do they grow up or do they stay as children? How do the parents know their child? Do they grow before their very eyes? Mother, no, I won't mention your name because I did not ask you in time, and I will not mention any name except with the person's actual permission. So, Mother, you've got it all wrong. Now, Read this carefully. People are on the other side, that is, in the astral. They're not children, and they're not old people. They are just what one might term an average, indeterminate age, because on the other side, years are different. But anyway, this person, an adult, let us say, decides to go back to Earth. He cannot go back as a fully grown adult, can he? He has to go through the usual channels, one might say. And so, this person goes to sleep, and when he wakes up, he's in the process of being born as a baby. Then he grows a bit, and let us, for the purpose of this illustration, say that when he is, 10 years of age, he dies and is buried. The astral is released from the body and goes back to the other side, where he says, in effect, "Well, that was a short stay, thank goodness. Now, what do I do next?" On the other side, he's not a child any longer. But supposing that, for some very, very important reason, he has to get in touch with those who were his parents on Earth, it would be no good giving them the impression of himself as an adult, as one perhaps older than the parents, so he impresses upon their subconscious a sight or vision of himself as a child. And the fond parents rejoice at having seen the spirit of their 10-year-old little boy, who came all the way from heaven to say, "Hi, folks," or whatever it is that he wanted to say. There are many authentic cases where people have materialized back on Earth for some special reason. And, of course, if they want to be recognized, and that, after all, is the main reason for materializing, then they have to materialize in a pattern which is readily recognizable to the people who knew that person before his death. So, always, the person materializes as a very healthy specimen of the age group to which he belonged when he passed over. He always looks more beautiful than the Earth child was, and that rejoices the parents' hearts. If the parents really do love the child, they can meet in the astral. And first, the child appears as just that, as the identical child which died to Earth and was reborn to the astral. But as soon as the parents can recognize this, then the child appears as his natural self. You must remember that although you have a mother and a father in this life, they are not necessarily the same mother and father you will have in 600 years' time. You may have been the father or the mother, depending on your sex, of course, in a previous life. Actually, people on Earth are just like a lot of actors coming to a stage. They take their clothes to suit the role they're going to play. So if an entity has to learn something as a woman, it would be useless for that entity to come to Earth as a man. So instead, she comes as a woman. And as a woman, to a class which will enable her to learn those things which she came to learn. I wonder how it is that so many beings come to this world for the first time and encounter hunger, poverty, injustice, etc., when they don't have any previous debts, and because karmic justice shouldn't be negative for them. Well, they have to come somehow, haven't they? It's impossible for a person coming to the Earth for the first time to come as a king or a queen. You can say they are new boys, as in new boys at school, you know, the newest of new boys. Most times have rather rough conditions. They're usually set upon by older boys, and until they've worked their way in, they're not necessarily popular with the teachers either. If one sets out as an apprentice, one gets all the worst jobs to do. Cleaning tools, cleaning equipment, sweeping floors, all the rest of it. And because they are only apprentices, they do not have much money. They might even feel hungry on occasion. It doesn't mean that their karma is at fault, because if they've just come to Earth for the first time, then they don't have much karma, do they? But we have to start somewhere. A person comes to the Earthbound for the first time, and nearly always that person is a member of some savage race, some really savage tribe, where he gets the rough corners knocked off and gets some training, no matter how rudimentary, of how humans go on. It is unheard of for a person to come to, let us say, Europe or North America as a first incarnation. He might come as a member of one of the savage backward tribes, such as in Africa or Australia, one of those places where so-called civilization is hardly touched. Then he has to live according to the equipment he has. That is he good-natured person or is he nasty-natured? If he's a good-natured person, then he will get on quite well. If he is unpleasant, then he wouldn't get on in any society at all. So even in the very savage tribes, a good-natured person makes out better than a bad-natured person. Later, the person incarnates into more and more advanced societies. By that time, of course, he has acquired a bit of karma, not merely against him, but also in his favor. So many have the utterly foolish notion that karma is oppression, and that's not it at all. It's like a bank account. If you do a person good, then you have money in the bank. If you do a person some ill, then in effect, you have lost money from the bank and you're in debt. If you are in debt, you have bad karma. If you have money in the bank, then you have a credit balance, and that credit is good karma. If you have good karma, you can do things that you want to do, and you can also trade on your good karma, so long as you do not do so much horse trading that your good karma or your credit balance disappears and you get into debt, because then you've got to work hard to get out of debt. It is said that we reincarnate many times, but the time we stay in the astral plane varies according to the degree of evolution we have reached. The number of people will probably have to decline or be stabilized in the future. So what happens to all the souls who cannot come down to this material world to continue their reincarnation? Or will they have to remain in the astral for longer than their karma really permits? And there again, you see, this talk about karma. People do not have to reincarnate because of their karma. They reincarnate because they want to learn something more. You don't necessarily go to college to pay somebody else. You go to college because you want to learn something. In just the same way, you come to Earth because you want to learn something. If you want to pay off karma, then you could pay off karma by staying in the astral. There is a lot to be done there, and in doing good for others, you do pay off karma. But if you just stay in the astral, well, you remain as you were, and you are, perhaps, a dropout from the school of Earth. If you want to progress more, you come down to Earth and have some additional lessons in hardship, in tolerance, in patience, and all that sort of thing. Get this quite clear. You do not come down to the Earth just because someone else says you have to. You do not come down to Earth and have some suffering just because you have misbehaved yourself. You come to learn. And if conditions are a bit hard, then there's no good blaming poor old karma for it. It's what you choose yourself. It's the conditions you set up for yourself. Too many people take a rather peculiar satisfaction in saying, "Oh, I couldn't help it. My karma was against me." Of course, there is karma, but then, of course, there are bank accounts. If you have something to sell or something which other people want, then you can get in money. If other people have something that you want, then you have to pay out for it, and that means you lose money. In the same way with karma, if you do good to others, then you are banking good karma. If you do ill to others, then you are losing your good and getting a debit of bad karma, which has to be paid off sometime, somewhere, not necessarily upon this earth. Remember, there are quite a lot of different worlds, and you will go to different worlds, just as at school you had to go from class to class, or grade to grade. End of chapter 10.